now, it's time to sit back and enjoy the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Broadcast.
Good news and bad news, girls. The good news is your dates are here.
What's the bad news?
They're dead.
Ah! See, a United States astro robot becomes a creature of death. Oh.
And Dave.
We have come here to this planet for one purpose only, to acquire breeding stuff to repopulate our planet.
He who breaks the law shall be punished. Back to the House of Pain.
Back to the House of Pain.
Everyone, and welcome to Bots, Bugs, and Babes, the B-Movie Podcast. From classic culture to the cheese between, the movies are B, but the entertainment is grade A. And I'm your host, Jason Giaconetti, and this time out, I have a British anthology movie. No, not that one either. This one is Amicus's The House That Dripped Blood, and I'll get to it right after this.
This house is full of sounds. The loudest is your heart pounding in the night. The softest is the sound of terror.
Is it?
Oh, Charles.
No, baby.
In this house, terror waits for you in every room.
Where are they? You must search the house, but you must find that doll.
Find them all in the house that dripped blood.
The House That Dripped Blood was released in England February 21st, 1971, and in the U.S. April 2nd of the same year, with a 102-minute running time. Now, your director here is Peter Duffel. Peter Duffel, who passed away in 2017, was an English television director and screenwriter. He wrote directed all kinds of TV films, and he was tapped here to do this one. He also did Partners in Crime in 61, which was an actual theatrical release, and then Inside Out, not that Inside Out, the one from 75. And then he did TV movies, Caught on a Train, Kings of the Wind, and then in 92 he did Genghis Khan, and then Tales of the Unexpected. He had done the episode in 1984 for that. Your writing credit, all of the stories were originally written by Robert Block. Yes, that Robert Block. And then another writing credit goes to Russ Jones, who helped write it. Now, Robert Block was brought in, and he if he wrote the stories originally, and I can tell you where some of them are from, he then also went on to do the scripting for this movie as well. This has got four main stories with a wraparound story told around each, and I'll give you the characters as we get to each of the stories. I'll tell you who they are. As I mentioned before, your production company is Amicus Productions, and for those of us who are a certain age, Amicus is known as the place that made the anthologies. They made Tales from the Crypt, they made Vault of Horror, they made Dr. Terror's House of Horrors, like, they made Torture Garden, they made Asylum, and The House That Dripped Blood is one of them. I love all of those things. Your budget here was just over 208 pounds. And then a box office says about $1 million, but, you know, all those numbers are kind of sketch from 1971. No one kept track of all those things as much. And this doesn't include re-releases and, you know, European stuff and home theater and, oh, not home theater, but like home video and yada, 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 all that stuff. Anyway. All right. So let's get cracking here. So we'll start with the framework. Now, in our framework story, we have the detective, Inspector Holloway, is played by John Bennett. A.J. Stoker, wink, wink, is played by John Bryans. And then Sergeant Martin is played by John Malcolm. Those are your people in that. All right, so let's start our wraparound story. So the first segment of the wraparound. Shortly after renting an old country house, film star Paul Henderson mysteriously disappears, and Inspector Holloway from Scotland Yard is called to investigate. Inquiring at the local police station, Holloway is told of some of the house's history. Okay, so let's get to the first segment. This segment is called Method for Murder, and this was from Fury number 7, July of 1962, by Robert Block. And in Method for Murder, it's easy for me to say, you have Denholm Elliott as he plays Charles. Joanne Dunham plays Alice, their husband and wife. Then you have Tom Adams as Richard slash Dominic, and you'll see what that means. And then Robert Lang as Dr. Andrews. Here we go. So we have a writer. Well, it's funny because Haley was kind of watching with me a little bit, and they said, we have a young couple, and these two people show up, and they are anything but young. But anyway, Charles Hiller, a hack writer who specializes in horror stories, and his wife Alice move into the house. Charles begins working on a novel focusing on Dominic, a murderous psychopathic strangler. Charles becomes simultaneously enamored and disturbed by the character. Charles soon starts seeing Dominic, who begins to stalk and torment him. Charles begins seeing a psychologist, Dr. Andrews, who suggests Dominic is the other half of a split personality formed by Charles getting into Dominic's mindset to write the novel. Charles's visions of Dominic become more prevalent. He sees Dominic strangling Alice, only for her to claim that Charles had been strangling her. At another session with Dr. Andrews, he suggests Dominic is the result of a darker side of Charles' personality being released by the writing of a novel. Though Charles is speculative, as he has written horror stories for years and never had a problem, suddenly Dominic arrives and strangles Dr. Andrews while Charles lies back in a chair with his eyes closed. When the doctor stops responding, Charles opens his eyes and jumps to his feet, backing away screaming in horror as Dominic laughs. Back at the house, Dominic approaches Alice, only to reveal that he is actually Richard, her lover, which is the, you know, nowadays we would see that twist coming, but back then I'm sure it got people. Why? Because we're cynical now? No. Richard, an actor who had been pretending to be Dominic to drive Charles insane so that Alice and Richard could take the money from his novels and run off together. Alice gets a call from the police and learns that both Dr. Andrews and Charles have been strangled to death. Alice asks Richard why he had killed them, as it was not part of the plan, only for Richard to reveal that now he believes he is Dominic. Richard slash Dominic then strangles Alice while laughing maniacally. And all these stories have people getting their comeuppance. It's very much in the all those EC horror, you know, Vault of Horror, Tales from the Crypt, you know, Haunt of Fear, things like that. Everyone always got their tales of suspense, things like that. Not tales of suspense, but suspense and whatever, fear and stuff like that. Everyone always got their comeuppance. Anyway, all right, so we now cut back to framework again. Sergeant Martin informs Holloway that Dominic was later, Richard Slice, was later found standing over Alice's body laughing. He says he believes that it was not merely a case of Richard Dominick being driven to madness by the role, but by the effect the house of itself. Holloway dismisses it as absurd, and so Martin tells him another story of the next tenant that happened to the house. And this one is called Waxworks, and this is from Weird Tales, Volume 33, Number 1, in January of 1939. So this is going back a skosh. Where are we here? So, your main players in Waxworks, of course, the incomparable Peter Cushing playing Philip Grayson, Joss Ackland playing Neville Rogers, and Wolf Morris as the Waxworks proprietor. Yes, Peter Cushing makes his appearance here. The one and only. Retired stockbroker Philip Grayson moves into the house. Though initially he occupies himself with hobbies, he quickly becomes lonely. One day, while wandering around town, he happens upon a wax museum. Grayson explores the museum and finds a sculpture of Salome, which resembles a dead woman he had been in love with. The museum's proprietor explains that it is based on the likeness of a sculpture after his late wife, who had been executed after murdering his best friend. Disturbed, Grayson vows to never return. His friend Neville arrives at his home while traveling for business. Grayson eagerly invites him to stay the night, and it becomes clear that the two had both romantic rivals for the same woman. However, the two have reconciled after her death. The next day, Grayson takes Neville around town, and the two spot the Wax Museum. Though Grayson tries to persuade him not to, Neville enters the Wax Museum and spots the sculpture, becoming obsessed with it. Neville tries to leave town, but is unable to abandon the sculpture. Staying at the local motel, he calls Grayson and informs him of his predicament. When Grayson arrives, he finds Neville has left the Wax Museum. They didn't leave the Wax Museum yet. Grayson goes to the museum and finds Neville's severed head has been added to the exhibit. The proprietor arrives to reveal that he has framed his wife for his friend's murder so that he could cover her corpse in wax and keep her for himself forever. However, both men continue to become enamored with her, Neville becomes obsessed, which puts him into a murderous rage. The proprietor then murders Grayson with an axe and adds his head to the Salome exhibit. Now, the poster for this movie has the female wax figure gets damaged during the battle and half her face is smashed, so her skeleton sticking out. And the poster, which also is a model, I'm trying to remember who put the model out, it's a bust. I don't remember. Sorry, guys. If you're listening, I'm sorry. I don't remember exactly who put this out. But I've definitely seen it before. And it's a naked woman, mostly naked woman, with a serving tray that holds the head of Peter Cushing on a silver platter, which, you know, kind of funny. Anyway, but yeah, so that's where it comes from. That's where the poster comes from. It's a great poster. A lot of people know that poster if they don't know this movie. It's from that part. All right, so we're back to the framework again. Holloway asks if Henderson moved in next, and he's told that there was one other tenant before him. However, Holloway does not stay around to hear this story, believing the whole thing preposterous, and instead decides to confer with the estate agent, A.J. Stoker. Stoker tells Holloway that he tried to warn them of the house's secret and asked Holloway if he has guessed it yet. Holloway ignores this and dismissing this too as absurd. Instead, asking him what happened to the tenant before Henderson. So Stoker explains. Now, this is from Weird Tales, Volume 39, Number 10, March of 1947, called Sweets to the Sweet. Sweets to the Sweet, this one we have here. Well, if we already had Peter Cushing, you know we better get Christopher Lee. So Chris Lee shows up here. Christopher Lee, yes, Sir Christopher Lee, as John Reed. Now, just as an aside, in the Waxworks, there's a Dracula, and it's clearly Christopher Lee as Dracula in the Waxworks in the previous segment, but I digress. Nyree Dawn Porter plays Ann Norton. Chloe Franks plays Jane Reed. That's Christopher Lee's daughter in this. Hugh Manning plays Mark, and Carlton Hobbs plays Dr. Bailey. He's not a type of bagel. Anyway, widower John Reed moves into the house along with his problematic young daughter Jane. She's not problematic. She's afraid of fire, that's for sure. So she has a pyro aversion. We don't know why at first, but like, I don't know if she's much of a problem. She's kind of definitely seems sheltered. Let's go with that. Sheltered. Shouldn't say problem. Jane. John hires a former teacher, Ann Norton, to tutor Jane. Ann gradually bonds with Jane, and she helps Jane get over her fear of fire and teaches her how to read, but begins to suspect John is abusive, as he doesn't allow her to play with other children or own toys, and does his best to keep her isolated. Norton confronts John about his parenting and asks if he blames Jane for the death of his wife, to which John responds that he is glad his wife is dead. Yep, that would not fly nowadays, but wait till you hear why. Norton manages to get John to allow her to buy Jane some toys. When John discovers a doll is among them, he immediately snatches it and tosses it into the fire. He's okay with educational toys. A puzzle, something along those lines, whatever. Dolls, fire, be gone. Right? Where are we here? From Jane tells her, Jane begins to secretly read books about witchcraft. One night during a blackout, John discovers some of the candles are missing, like all the candles are missing except for four. John angrily questions Jane about this and slaps her, to Anne's horror. Jane secretly uses the missing candles to form a wax voodoo doll and uses the hair from his electric shaver to infuse in the doll to make the voodoo doll of John. If you didn't get where this was going now, I mean, we can't signpost this much more. All right, he reveals to Anne that Jane's mother was a witch, and that Jane is one as well. And the reason for his parenting method is to stop Jane from harming anybody. When Jane begins to attack John via the voodoo doll once again, he instructs Anne to find the doll and take it from her to stop her from killing him. Anne finds Jane standing next to the burning fireplace holding the doll. Anne tries to convince her to give her the doll, but Jane tosses the doll into the fire. Anne listens as hard as John burns to death. And Jane smiles evilly. Yes, a little evil girl in this one. Yes, folks. Not every anthology has an evil little girl, but a lot of them tend to. And because you look at this little blonde girl, she seems totally innocent, totally naive, totally, you know, oh, she's safe, and she's a witch. So that's what happens. All right, here we go. We're up to framework number four, and we're closing in. Holloway dismisses the story as the most ridiculous so far, and demands that the realtor tell him about Henderson. Stoker clarifies that he wanted Henderson not to take it, not believing it would be the right for his personality, but states that he gave it once Henderson insisted. Then he tells him the final story. Now, the final story is called The Cloak. John Petcheri, it plays Paul Henderson. Ingrid Pitt, yes, Ingrid Pitt, oof, plays Clara Lind. Ingrid Pitt, when I met her, well, I don't know, in the 2000s, might be in the 2010s, she was gorgeous then. This is 1971 prime Ingrid Pitt. She was in it, and she's a stunning woman. And my wife knows that, so it's not like, oh, I'll go tell Kelly. Yeah, and not unheard of. The woman's gorgeous. You can see it as she's just on screen. She's radiant. And she was very nice in person, too. Jeffrey Baldon plays Theo, and Jonathan Lynch plays Mr. Pentridge. All right, here we go. Temperamental veteran horror film actor Paul Henderson moves into the house while starring in a vampire film being shot nearby. Henderson, a great fan of the horror genre, is angry over the lack of realism in the film, particularly over the cloak worn by his character, who happens to be a vampire. He decides to purchase a more accurate cloak, and to that end stops at an antique shop run by the enigmatic Theo von Hartmann. Von Hartmann offers him a black cloak after listening to Henderson's demand, and Henderson purchases it. Before he leaves, Von Hartmann tells him to use the cloak for its intended purpose. While in the makeup room, Henderson finds that when he wears the cloak, he has no reflection. Later that day, while shooting a scene where he sucks the blood from his co-star and girlfriend Carla, that's Ingrid Pitt, Paul begins to genuinely trying to suck her blood, even after the scene ends. A horrified caller demands he stays away from her. At midnight, the witching hour, Paul puts on the cloak again as a test. He grows fangs, begins to fly, much to his horror. Paul reads in the newspaper that Von Hammer's shop was burned down and Von Hartmann's corpse has been found inside. The corpse is identified as being several hundred years old. Paul realizes that Von Hartmann was a vampire and he gave Henderson the cloak so that he could pass his powers to Henderson, allowing him to die. Henderson apologizes to Carla and invites her over to his home. He explains to her his predicament, but she is skeptical and demands he proves it by putting on the cloak. Henderson is reluctant, as it is midnight, but he ultimately complies. Paul revealed to find is relieved to find that nothing happens, but he quickly realizes the cloak has been substituted with a prop. Carla dons the cloak and reveals that she is actually a vampire sent to turn Henderson into another vampire, as most vampires admire his portrayal of their kind. Carla flies towards the screaming Henderson, beginning to turn him into a vampire. Now, when Ingrid picks going up in the air, you can... this is the problem with not watching this on VHS anymore, let alone on DVD, let alone on Blu-ray, but like, as cleaned up as everything is, I'm watching this giant TV, 100% you can see the wire. I don't care. I'm just saying, 100% you can see it. Anyway, so Holloway refuses to believe Stoker and goes to the house, despite it being nearly midnight and the house having no electricity. He explores the house by candlelight, eventually breaking into a locked basement where he finds and kills Henderson, now a transformed vampire. So he kills him. He breaks the stool, and he grabs a piece of the stool and stabs him right in the heart. And then poof, he's gone. No sparkles, no fire, no dust, just poof, gone. And now you're thinking, well, Carla's there too. She's going to turn a vampire. Why not grab another piece of the stool? But he didn't, because, you know, that's how that works. The next morning, Stoker walks up to the house and breaks the fourth wall by talking to the audience. I know, you're not supposed to do that, but it happens. Asking if they understood the secret of the house, that it reflects the personality of whoever is living in it, and treats them accordingly. He muses that perhaps the audience would be suitable, and that there is nothing to be afraid, provided they're the right sort of person. Ooh, there we go, and then credits roll, and yada yada. Now, this production, obviously, Freddie Francis was a sought-after director for The Chair, but he couldn't because he had other commitments. And then, obviously, they had thought about using separate different people, but later they went with one director. The scene in which Henderson talks about his favorite roles, he refers to Bela Lugosi's Dracula rather than the chap that plays him nowadays, which is, of course, a shot at Christopher Lee as like a little wink, wink, nudge, nudge, know what I mean? But, you know. So, a lot of this, the reviews on this are about the same. It's the everyone always compares this to the they say this is a solid attempt by Amicus at horror anthology, neatly made, generally pleasing, but it's a low level of originality to the writing because they are just comic book stories, and even though I love them as comic book stories, don't get me wrong, it's just kind of hard when you're like, you know, these are stories written years ago. And we look at it now, and we have to remember, like, well, yeah, this is taking place in the 1970s and before, so, you know, things that wouldn't be there. But I know that's not a problem for me, because as anybody who's listening to the show knows, I am a lover of physical media. I love stuff that's old. I have no problem looking at stuff that's quote-unquote retro, but it's not retro to me, especially if we were alive then, even though I wasn't alive for this. The idea being is a lot of people nowadays might just blow this off. Because it's not Tales from the Crypt, the name they know. Because it's not Vault of Horror, which they may or may not know. Dr. Terror's House of Horrors, you know, kind of thing. They know some of the other names in it. This one, if you don't know who Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing are, there's no names here they're going to draw you in. Because if you don't know who they are, you probably don't know who Ingrid Pitt is. And the reality is that this is exactly the kind of stuff we got from Amicus. And it's solid. It is... not my favorite of all time, obviously. I do. Doctor's House of Horrors is hard to beat. And Tales from the Crypt and Vault of Horror. All of those are really, really good. In fact, I can't think of a bad anthology from Amicus. But there's some that I just remember more because I've seen them more. This is one of the ones that I had not seen until much later. Because while it came out on a DVD in England, in PAL, it didn't hit America until 2003, and then they had the and that was Lionsgate, and that was a very bare bones, if I remember, that's a very bare bones disc. And then there was another one came out in a region one from Hen Tooth Video in 2013. Now, what I have is I have the Shout Factory, aka Scream Factory, the 2018 release, which is the Blu-ray. And of course, I got this streaming right on Prime when I watched it here too, so you can see it there. So it's available. You just got to reach out and look for it. Obviously, This is the kind of stuff that I enjoy. I've always said I enjoy amicus horror. I've enjoyed anthologies. The only thing about anthologies is when they're done well, they get in and get out. You don't have to spend 2 hours with a character getting to know them. Even the wraparound story, if they do it well, you actually get to know the people, but yet you don't have to live with them. And that's not a bad thing to live with people in a story. But at times, like these quick hitters, you don't need to know. You don't need to know the entire backstory of what happened with the wife. You kind of get it quickly in the one with the Sweets to the Sweet. You don't need to know all about the details of the murder in the Waxworks one. All those you don't need to know those things. None of that stuff is needed. You just kind of like, okay, we're good to go. And I understand that nowadays anthologies are kind of looked upon maybe not as favorable with certain audiences, but those audiences also are the first one to complain when something's too long. You know, in this whole TikTok-y world where everything has to be clips and reels and shorts and whatever, an anthology kind of should fit better, but it doesn't seem to. And I'm reminded of when we covered Trick or Treat on Michael Dougherty's movie on The Vault. And that's a great anthology. And each story obviously interacts with the other. But what a visceral, like blood and guts movie at times, and it's funny and it's witty, and that's what anthologies should be. They should kind of not all be the exact same tone and kind of punch you in the mouth or make you laugh or whatever, unless they're comedies. But most anthologies are not comedies. Anthologies tend to work better in the horror genre more than anything else, because you can tell a quick hitter in and out and be done with it. Have you seen The House That Dripped Blood? You probably know the poster. Even if you ain't seen it, you probably know the poster. Did you see this? Did you see this maybe in the 70s? Did you see it? I mean, are you old enough to have seen it in 71, maybe when it came out? That'd be cool. Let me know. I'd love to hear from you. This is a movie that I know my brother and I, again, we didn't see this when we were younger, but we saw it once it came out on DVD and stuff like that. We've seen it. And this is a movie that I know my dad also seen. This is one of the ones, again, not everyone's favorite amicus movie, but this is one of the ones that when I first got the DVD, had to get the DVD, probably came from Amazon or something. I don't know if it was 2003, I might have still been, I'm not depending when it came. I would still be kind of living at home and stuff like that. And I know I watched this with my dad a long, long time ago. I don't know if he's seen it since, but it's one of those things. It's just fun, kind of pop it on. Not super deep, not going to change your life, but an enjoyable time. So anyway, folks, that's just me jibber jabbering away here. If you have any thoughts about this, let me know. Do you have other anthologies that you love that's like maybe that are not amicus? I'd love to hear about it. Let me know, because anthologies are something I enjoy. I enjoy the heck out of. In fact, a lot of times I enjoy anthology movies better than I would like certain TV shows, even though TV shows can look at the episodic and anthologies can look as episodic. There's not a ton of newer TV that I really enjoy, because I think sometimes they get too long, episodes being an hour and 10 minutes per episode, which is great. Like Stranger Things, I love Stranger Things, but there are times when you're like, man, they probably could have cut that down a skosh. They kind of probably could have tightened that up a little bit. I'm thinking of some of the Marvel, the Marvel TV series, whereas like the first season of Daredevil I thought was awesome and kick butt. Some of the later series, not necessarily Daredevil, but like Jessica Jones, stuff like that, some of them, they needed to tighten up things. Like kind of like, not every episode needs to be, some episode could be 46 minutes, an episode could be 51 minutes. I think you need to just kind of tighten them up and get them where they need to be. But that's another story for another day. Anyway, folks, I want to thank everyone for the downloads and listens. This is a labor of love. I ain't making a dime doing this. So this is all just straight up for you guys trying to share my love for movies and horror and all those bots, bugs, and babes that are out there in the world. Anyway, folks, keep those cards and letters coming and keep watching those skies.
This is Tokyo, once a city of 6 million people. What has happened here was caused by a force which, up until a few days ago, was entirely beyond the scope of man's imagination. Tokyo, a smoldering memorial to the unknown. An unknown which at this very moment still prevails and could at any time lash out with its terrible destruction anywhere else in the world.
Hi, folks. Luke Giaconetti here. I'd like to ask you a few questions. Do you like giant monsters? Or as they're called in Japan, Daikaiju? Monsters like Godzilla, Rodan, Gamera, King Ghidorah, or Mothra? Do you like more obscure monsters, such as Gappa or Yangari? Do you like giant heroes like Ultraman, or super robots like the Shogun Warriors? If you answered yes to any of these questions, then I think you might like my podcast, Earth Destruction Directive. I'm a dedicated fan of all things Daikaiju, and I'd like to share that with all of you. Please check out Earth Destruction Directive at twotruefreaks.com. Earth Destruction Directive, where we turn your Daikaiju dreams into city-smashing reality.
This has been an episode of Bots, Bugs, and Babes, the B-Movie Podcast. If you'd like to contact me, please email the show at botsbugsbabes@gmail.com. If you'd like to find me online, I'm on Facebook under my name, Jason Giaconetti. I often contribute to the Two True Freaks Facebook group. You can visit my Facebook page, The Art of Horror Collective, and you can search the hashtag The Art of Horror Collective. On Instagram, find me under my name, Jason Giaconetti, and search the hashtag The Art of Horror Collective, as well as the new hashtag Bots, Bugs, Babes Podcast. I'm the only one using them. I'm also on Twitter at Jason Giaconetti, and you can visit my webpage at www.theartofhorrorcollective.wordpress.com. All movies, characters, stories, music, etc. are properties of their respective holders. This is a fan work, and any use of any property is purely for review, discussion, entertainment. So don't sue me. I ain't got anything anyway.
There is no tomorrow! There is no tomorrow! There is no tomorrow!
Will you stop?